We are the advocates for our customers to help make our products better for them. We're the advocates of our products to go out to our customers and make sure they understand what we can do for them. We go out into communities that maybe haven't understood that Microsoft is relevant to them in the past because the company has changed a lot in recent years. I would even say that I wouldn't have come to this company 10 years ago. Never imagined that I would, but here I am. And we have a bunch of tech that's relevant to a lot of people and they don't know about it. So we're out kind of educating the world and then educating ourselves based on what our customers want. I was at a company called Sechs Wunderkinder in Berlin. We created a product called Wunderlist and joined Microsoft via being acquired. So I was the CTO of that company and part of selling the company to Microsoft. Maybe I'd already dropped out of college, I don't know, but I was a professional musician. And I played every night on Beale Street in Memphis, Tennessee, in soul bands, R&B bands. And my dad gave me a PC, and the only program on it was Doom. And I fell in love with it, and I got to be one of the world's best Doom deathmatch players because I was so obsessed. I even have a tattoo of the Doom God Mode avatar on my arm. And because I loved it so much, I wanted to understand how it worked. So I'd go play on Beale Street until 3 in the morning and go home and dial into the university network using serial line IP and use Gopher to search the internet, because that's what you did instead of browsers back then, to learn how to program. I dug into Visual Basic, actually, but only because I had no idea what I should learn. The first one that I really dug into, though, intensely was Perl. And that was a mess. But I was it very quickly became an open source nerd. In the mid 90s, I was installing Linux back when you had to spend all day downloading disk images and then burning them one at a time to floppies. And it would take like literally 2 or 3 days to get Linux installed on a single computer. And Perl was the language of choice for people who were into that kind of thing. Computer programs were a lot less reliable then, I guess. Doom installations would get corrupted, and people were pretty addicted to playing Doom Deathmatch. So in the local community, you pretty much played with people who were local most of the time, because the way you did internet gaming was talk on IRC on the internet and then call people long distance with your phone. So you can't afford to do a lot of that. But people's Doom installations would get corrupted, and I became the person who could figure out how to fix their Doom installation for them. And a friend of mine who played saxophone in the bands with me was in IT as a day job, literally applied for a job for me because he said, "You're good at this, you should do this." And he was pretty codependent. He just wanted me to go to work with him too, so he'd have someone to drive with. He applied for a job on his team, tricked me into going to an interview with his manager, told his manager I was good, and she didn't interview me. She just gave me a job. That's how I got into IT. Spent a long time in enterprise, actually, and even in academia doing IT stuff. About 6 years into my career, I had gone from help desk, the first thing that I was not even interviewed for, and I got my first job, rapidly through the ranks, because I was extremely shy, and I had imposter syndrome because I literally was an imposter. I didn't know anything. So I had to view my career like a game, and I thought of it as like a role-playing game. Obviously, I like games. That's why I was into the whole thing, right? And so I kind of just mapped out a skill tree for myself, and I had like 3 areas of the skill tree, and I decided how I wanted to go, and I thought about leveling up. And so I always had my eye on the next level, just like if you're playing a role-playing game. So I very quickly went from help desk to doing service calls, to being the person that sits in the back and just tells people what to do, to being the person that designs all the systems, to being a programmer, to being an architect. And ultimately, I worked at GE. I got sent to India to start a software development center there. And while I was there, we went from 0 people, except for me, to 350 when I left. I lived in Bangalore. And I hired the executive team that worked there and everything, basically just handed it off and left at the end. I became everyone's de facto mentor because I guess I had this kind of weird career trajectory, and everyone wanted to know how they could do it too. And when I moved back, someone I knew from the open source world, his name's Dave Thomas, had started a publishing company and asked me, why don't you write a book about all that stuff that you talked about when you were in India? And you know, basically write a book about how you've had such a remarkable career, which, you know, that was 14 years ago. So to think I had a remarkable career then is kind of stupid, but you know, I guess it was pretty remarkable. So I wrote a book for Pragmatic Bookshelf called My Job Went to India and All I Got Was This Lousy Book. Worst title ever. It's now called The Passionate Programmer, which I think captures the essence more. But once I wrote that, I started getting invited to keynote at conferences. And of course, I was doing open source stuff. I had started organizing my own conferences. I got into the Ruby programming language very early. And I founded the International Ruby Conference. And then when Ruby on Rails came along, I founded the International Rails Conference. And it just all sort of started piling up. I was writing books. And then around 2005, after Rails came out, suddenly, Ruby went from being this stupid thing people made fun of me for playing with to every startup in the world develops their apps with Ruby. Literally, if you weren't using Ruby, people would ask you, why aren't you using Ruby? So now I'm suddenly in demand. I'm at this big company still, managing a team. And a friend of mine from the open source world asked me one day, is it your destiny to work at GE for the rest of your life? And I said, oh no. It isn't. And that's when I jumped out and I started doing startup stuff. And I guess that was 13 years ago now. Wow. So this is my first return to a big company now, having been acquired from Wunderlist. It's hard to say, partially because I'm remote. I don't get the same perks that a lot of the people that are at some of the headquarters places are. That said, I'm remote. I'm remote and I'm playing an executive role with a large team. That's pretty unusual. You don't see that much in the industry, so I'd call that the perk. You know, I live in Arkansas next to a lake, and then I travel all over the world because my job takes me there. My team is distributed all over the world as well. Microsoft, what I've noticed about diversity and inclusivity here is it is more than a meeting you have to have and a training you have to go through on occasion. I have never been somewhere where it is so front and center of top of mind for every leader that I interact with. So it would probably take too long to even describe how it's handled here. But what I can say is it permeates. And of course, you know, we like everyone, every other company in the world have a lot to learn and a lot to improve on, but it's ever present. I play music. I flipped from that being my job to that being my hobby. Honestly, I think if more musicians did that, we'd have better music in the world. But after years of mostly playing rock music on the guitar, I've switched back to playing saxophone and doing jazz, and my hobby is turning into something kind of serious. I've recorded a few records recently and am shopping around the labels. So doing avant-garde jazz music that almost no one who listens to this podcast would actually want to listen to.